It is Saturday, June 7th, 2008, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, the Week in Geek News, and your questions and comments of technology. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today we're covering the Week in Geek News, and in the second half, I welcome you to join our conversation about technology. This is Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, Sean Cleveland, Senior Technical Marketing Manager at NVIDIA. Morning, Sean.
Good morning.
Ben Jaffe, Slacker and Media Dude.
Morning.
And Mr. Miles Elam, student, programmer, and political junkie. Miles.
Good morning.
Miles, I think I'll start with you for the Geek News.
10 airports are installing full-body scanners.
Don't we already have full-body scanners? I mean, they detect metal. What do these things do?
No, these are actually imaging. This is you step into a chamber, and there is a picture done taken of you in 3D, but basically without your clothes.
So it goes through your clothing.
Right. Where it can show, you can clearly see what gender the person is. Uh-huh. Let's put it that way. It's being installed in airports in Los Angeles, Baltimore, Denver, Albuquerque, New York City.
Like seven main airports.
Right.
Is this a pilot program, or is this a real, like, every passenger will be scanned kind of thing?
No, this is actually at random you are chosen to be scanned. It's not every passenger, or at least not at this point.
Is it safe?
Is it safe for the person being scanned?
Yeah.
It depends on what you consider safe. Is it harmful physiologically? No.
But psychologically, possibly.
Well, the question comes – the thing is the person who is viewing the images is not sitting right next to you. They thought that it would be very disturbing for the person to see an image of themselves in this fashion, I think for fairly obvious reasons. And it is less intrusive than someone, say, giving you a strip search. But
yes,
it is not technically very different from giving a strip search.
So this is like the movie Total Recall when Schwarzenegger's character goes through a scanner and you can see the skeleton structure.
No, that one was showing a skeleton structure. This is not actually going beneath the skin to show the skeleton structure. This is showing the body without clothes or the silhouette of items that are on the body. So you can see, for example, the sweat on someone's back. Or, I mean, you're seeing the person without
clothing.
Concealment,
yeah.
Yes.
And so they're not – the viewer is actually going to be somewhere else in the building?
Oh, in an adjacent room,
To me, that's even creepier. You'd kind of want to know the person that's looking at you, wouldn't you?
See, that's what I would think. How would this be different than, say, you were coming up, you're given a drug like you had this when you were having surgery, Lyle, that would make you forget.
Right.
Then you went into a room, strip searched. And then afterwards, you didn't remember it. You didn't actually feel anything. You don't have that memory of a traumatic event. But someone actually looked at every part of you.
Yeah. What's the technology that makes this work, Miles?
That's a fine question.
This is a geek show, man. We got to talk about the technology. All right. You know what?
Sorry. The scanners bounce harmless millimeter waves off of the passengers.
Okay.
That's just spooky.
It is.
So it's not magnetism. It is some type of...
Okay, here's a question for you. If
some frequency of light or radio wave.
Who here wouldn't want a photograph or a video of this, of their own body? Any of you guys want that? See, if I used it, I'd want a copy. Like, I'd be like, okay, I'll do this, but I want a copy of it. Is that geeky or is that just weird?
That's geeky.
I was actually thinking, if you really wanted that, why wouldn't you just take a picture of yourself nude?
Because it looks different. You know it looks different.
You know what? I gotta say, when I approach the metal detector, I'm barefoot, I have no belt on, I have no jacket on, I'm just in pants and a shirt.
Yeah.
How many people are actually getting through with guns on them? Is this really needed?
Yeah, I don't think it is.
That's kind of what I want to know.
I just don't hear about
that happening.
And in fact, is that tube of toothpaste actually a threat?
Right. Let's go on, shall we? Ben.
Okay. So there, in 1998, there was the DivX rental system, which was debuted, and it was a catastrophic failure. And the way it worked basically was, and this relates to the present day, I promise. It was a rental format where you had to buy a special player, and you would rent these DVDs, and they would be viewable for 48 hours. And then after the 48 hours, they would pretty much be useless to you.
Right.
And
you self-destruct.
They would self-destruct. Funny.
Without harming you.
Yeah.
No explosion. Get Smart, where it blows up.
Yeah, exactly. This CD will self-destruct.
Get it out of the house.
And then you could pay a continuation fee, and it would talk to your DVD player and make the DVD work for another 48 hours.
This is a different technology.
Oh, yeah.
I recall like plastic sheets that you'd have to rip open. After once you rip it open, the oxygen gets to this media, and then it degrades.
And then it would deteriorate, and there was no way to bring it back.
Right. Funny, you just covered the second half of my story. Staples is going to start using, this is called FlexPlay. It's very similar, and the only difference is that you don't need a special player. So that was the main reason why DivX. Oh, by the way, it's called DivX, and it shouldn't be confused with a DivX codec. They're two completely different things.
Right.
It's just a capitalization.
Okay,
difference.
So this FlexPlay, which is a horrible marketing term, but go on.
So yeah, FlexPlay, because you know you can play.
This is probably a standard DVD.
This is just a standard DVD with a special chemical layer, and it oxidizes it oxidizes and renders the DVD eventually unplayable after about 48 hours. And there's no way to read it again. It's
gone.
Dead. You can throw it away.
So you're basically, yeah, well, that sounds like a lot of throwing away.
A lot of throwing
away.
Okay,
how about this, though? I can make a system that would allow you to play it forever.
Really?
Yeah. You just encase your DVD player with a bag, and then you fill it with nitrogen, and then you open in stuff in that nitrogen environment. Oxygen never touches it, never oxidizes, and you get to play forever.
That's a good idea.
I've got a good idea.
Uh-huh.
How about not treating your customers like they're criminals?
Sounds good to me. And let's move. Thank you, Ben, for that story about self-destructing DVDs. Always a fun topic. Mr. Cleveland?
Fun.
Technically, it's
as we know, gas prices are going up. I don't know if you guys knew that or not. I've kind of noticed, even though I have a hybrid, it's costing me $10 more a gas fill-up. So instead of $20, it's $30?
Yep.
Oh, my God.
You're only paying $30? Jeez. I'm paying $45 to fill up my tank.
Yeah, but I'm doing it every 4 days. Ouch. But then again, I'm, you know.
Commuting too much. I've been doing that weekend. So I haven't enjoyed it.
I shouldn't be complaining as much as other people because I do have a hybrid. What's interesting is future hybrids, there is a company called Innerdale that intends to have a manufacturing line operating by 2010 that is capable of making 300,000 car batteries a year for hybrid electric vehicles.
That's a good market to be in.
And they're talking about a 2-year payback for buyers of future hybrids because these lithium-ion batteries that are developed bring the cost down substantially. So it's kind of interesting that, you know, since they're shifting from lithium to lithium from nickel, I'm curious to see how well this lithium technology works because we all know that lithium done wrong can have catastrophic effects.
So not just for hybrids, though. This would be for pure electric vehicles, too, right?
Well, no, this is for hybrids. They're specifically saying for cars that run partially on battery and partially with an internal combustion engine. So they need to be recharged. The problem with it, I guess.
Well, I mean, electric cars are recharged too. I mean, right?
I just don't know if they would have the capacity to power an electric vehicle the distance, because they're not specifically saying that.
Also, if they're selling battery packs to the consumer, you'd assume that those aren't for brand new cars. And right now, there aren't very many electric cars, but there's quite a few hybrid cars being sold. So in 2010, the market would be for hybrid vehicles.
So they're promising that their battery chemistry and design are safe and they're promising better battery life and performance. Kind of interesting. But something else that I think we should link to our website is this online calculator that's in the story that's available at fueleconomy.gov.
Okay.
And this is really interesting. It allows you to plug in a number of things like the average mile per gallon of your car, the fuel price per gallon, your average mile per gallon, how many miles you drive, and when you plan to own your car. And it tells you, for example, that a vehicle that gets 30 miles per gallon will cost about $663 less to fuel each year than one that gets 20 miles per gallon. So if you really want to get an idea, if you're going to buy a car, a new car, used car, you can plug this data in and get an idea of what it's going to cost to run. We'll put that link up at our site.
So that geekspeak.org. So that would basically enable you to find out if you're really going to be saving any money based on the size of the car and the gas mileage and all of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you say that's a fueleconomy.gov?
Yeah, it's fueleconomy.gov.
Okay. I'm trying to find the calculator to link directly to it. It looks like a lot of resources actually for miles per gallon ratings for 2008 and things of that nature. All right, thank you, Mr. Cleveland. Miles, please, next news story, sir.
The Firefox web browser has released candidate, but the news here is that the organization behind Firefox is trying to set a Guinness World Record for the most software downloaded in 24 hours. And so I'll be putting up a link on the website for clicking there. So on the day when you'll receive an email, you put your email address in and you'll receive an email to find out which day to download it. You can download it and be part of Firefox making history.
Okay, so is this the newer version?
Yes.
Okay.
And I highly recommend it. Works much better than Firefox.
You've been using the beta?
Or the release candidate is actually what I'm on right now. But yes, absolutely. And this also goes along with the fact that the Firefox browser is on pace to hit 20% market share next month.
Wow. That's impressive.
So it's pulling back again. And just as a plug for the alternative browsers to Internet Explorer, Safari is also getting a next-generation JavaScript interpreter. That in the next version of Safari, it's already in the top of trunk, a development term for new development code. So we'll be seeing this within the next 6 months, likely.
What library differences are the new ECMA script or new JavaScript?
The library difference is that everything runs twice as fast.
So the interpreter
sometimes
is
up to 150% of the speed. And
I was trying to make a particle effects engine for a game for my kids with JavaScript. No. It's just not there. It's not fast enough.
And for folks that were thinking, oh, the web wars are dead, they're heating up again, and it's actually kind of exciting to be in web development again.
You know,
stuff coming up.
Ben and I have been installing an art show in San Jose this last week, and a few of the students are using, the artists are using Opera as the browser, and right built into it is kiosk mode where it goes full screen completely. There's a whole bunch of features in it that are just built in that are really quite nice. I'm thinking about using Opera more.
Well, Firefox actually can do kiosk mode as well.
Yeah, F11, right?
Yeah, but you can also start up an application to say, to configure it to say it always opens up in a kiosk mode.
All right, very cool. Thank you, Miles.
Yeah, I go through phases. I went through the Safari phase, and then I went through the Opera phase, and I went through
phase.
Now I'm using Firefox. Then I was using Firefox 3 beta, now I'm using the release candidate.
Candidate 1 last week, and it was. There were some small things that were happening. Video was getting really choppy. But in IE, it worked fine. Like, what is going on? So I found Release Candidate 2, and it fixed it.
Yeah, nice.
Mm-hmm. I was about ready to move for a little while. I know how it goes.
So all of you guys are happy. Firefox users. I've been using
Internet Explorer. I use both, actually, Safari and Firefox. One thing to worry about Safari is that it still has that carpet bombing exploit where you can download a whole bunch of files on there.
For more information about the carpet bombing exploit of Safari on the Windows machine, see last week's episode of GeekSpeak, the 31st of May.
But at the same time, this Safari improvement will eventually very likely show up in the iPhone, where speed is an issue.
Yeah, yeah.
And also in Google's Android, their mobile phone platform, because they are using WebKit as well.
Oh, they are.
Which is the engine behind Safari.
Why is Google using WebKit and not Firefox for their browser?
Because WebKit is smaller.
Huh. WebKit was designed before Apple took it over. What group was it?
No, WebKit was what Apple made of the KHTML engine of the KDE project, commonly known on the Linux platform.
Commonly known on the Linux platform.
Well, I mean, that library is available for
with
a Windows port, but that's where it originally came from, and it was very small code, and that's why Apple went after it, saying, hey, it does all this stuff on a really small code base. Let's use this as a base instead of the Mozilla engine, which is much larger, has probably more features, but different targets.
Thank you very much, Miles, for that. And, of course, all the news stories we cover, we put links for more information on geekspeak.org. Sean, I'm going to go to you for the next news story, sir.
Yeah, this story's a little deep, but we'll just go with the top.
All right.
You know, the easy-to-grok part. MIT developed a, well, as they say in their own news, a paper towel for oil spills. It's made of nanowire mesh that can absorb up to 20 times its weight in oil.
Wow.
So really so interesting use of nanowire technology.
It's the nano brawn or power picker-upper.
It's a mat of nanowires with the touch and feel of paper. And of course, it's, you know, some 200,000 tons of oil have already been spilled at sea. And as we know, it's those first few hours that are critical into cleaning up an oil spill.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that they're making new materials that can absorb more and actually hold it is really it's really beneficial.
And in addition, from what I was reading on that article, was that the mat is hydrophobic and has an absorption of other things that are hydrophobic, like oil. It doesn't mix with water. And so that's apparently something to do with how it works. And I don't know the exact details of it, but
it gets very technical. But yeah. We'll put the link up on our site. And if anybody's interested, then go check it out.
The basic idea here is to have a lot of surface area where the liquid can be wicked into the surface.
Exactly.
But not do it to water.
Exactly.
Very interesting they can do that. So basically it's like a sponge, but if you threw the sponge in water, it would stay dry. If you threw it in oil, it would soak up the oil.
As the way they say, it allows for a great deal of capillary action.
Yeah. That's the word I was looking for, is capillary. Great word. Thanks, Mr. Kemp from biology in high school. cool. I'm assuming not in production. This is like pilot phases in the laboratory.
Yeah.
But could be promising. Ben.
So the RIAA and the MPAA and the ESA, all of the...
was impressive.
Yeah, that's my news story.
Great. No. And Ben can use acronyms.
All right, yeah. No, they are sending an increasing number of takedown notices each year for copyright infringement and everything. But there have been several studies that show that there is a large flaw in how these groups report file sharing and how they test for illegal file sharing as well. A lot of times they only look at the IP addresses as opposed to the actual data that's being exchanged.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, actually, in one of these studies, the researchers rigged three LaserJet printers, which were then accused several times of downloading illegal versions of Iron Man and the Indiana Jones film and everything. And
they basically had HP printers doing BitTorrent traffic requests.
Faking,
but of course, they can't do anything
sharing
with it, because there's actually no, like, you couldn't actually get the data off of it.
Yeah, exactly.
Printing it or not?
Yeah, printing and shredding it, actually. but anyway, yeah, it's kind of, I mean, it's not particularly surprising that they're not necessarily looking at the data exchanged, because using those methods would require a lot more bandwidth and CPU, and they wouldn't be able to send out as many. Because of this, people who are not file sharing can receive complaints, innocent users. And also, pretty much anyone can be framed for copyright infringement using the techniques that they were testing in their research. And I'm not sure how likely it is to happen in the real world, but it's definitely possible in theory and with the right access to...
Okay. Well, thank you, Ben, for that. Sean, I wanted to ask you about something. I recently saw a great article on Engadget.com about OCZ's, it's a corporation, making a do-it-yourself gaming laptop, mm-hmm. notebook.
Yeah.
They're not called laptops anymore. They're called notebooks. And basically, it's like a shell of a laptop. You get a lot of stuff with it, and then you can put your own processor in it. It's kind of like a build-your-own laptop or notebook, excuse me. What do you think about that idea of being able to do that?
Yeah, the price was pretty cool.
Yeah, the price is cheap. It's like under $700.
It's like, yeah, but it didn't come with a memory or CPU, right? You had to buy that yourself.
That's right. It came with a PM965 chipset from NVIDIA.
No, that's Intel.
Oh, Intel, excuse me. And then the NVIDIA 8600.
Or 8800M, right?
It says 8600M in this.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great. I'm just concerned about the screen. I buy a notebook. I would buy a notebook on screen quality. 15 inches is good. What's the resolution, though?
Right.
I don't want to get a non-standard resolution, something that's too widescreen, because, frankly, you look at your document and it's squished.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to look at a half a page of a document and have to scroll down all the time to read the rest.
So it says you have to supply, and it also has DVD brain, you have to supply your own processor, your own memory, and your own OS, of course, and your own hard drive, and possibly even your Wi-Fi and Bluetooth. All has to be included separately. So I've got a question. What kind of processor? Does this have to be a certain memory?
It's a mobile.
Mobile processor.
Yeah, you're not be able to put a desktop processor.
Our mobile processor, like the machine you're using right now in front of you, what is that? Is it Toshiba?
Yeah.
Does that have a mobile processor that's not soldered on that you can actually unplug it and put it back in or not? Do you know?
You know, most enthusiasts type notebooks have those kind of capabilities.
You
I don't think this one does.
So this one is just another version
of
that.
So, yeah. Yeah, they're taking enthusiast parts and putting it down into a smaller form factor.
I get the reason for doing this. What you get to do with a do-it-yourself notebook is that the shell of all the parts that have to fit together really tight are included, and anything that's flexible,
you know, the
you
truth
can
is most all of these notebooks come from just a few manufacturers.
Really?
Lenovo, and there's, you know, in Asia. And the shells are made specifically for the for the OEM. They're made for HP and
Dell,
yeah, Apple and Dell. So, but they're all made in just a few places. So the HP would get the notebook and then they would put the parts in.
Right. So this is just selling it without the parts.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. But there's a few things you just need to be careful of. You don't want to buy a cheap shell. You don't want to buy something that can be banged around really easy. I'd be worried about if you put a powerful processor in something like that, it's got to be cooled. And is the cooling, the heat sink and the cooling mechanism in that notebook good enough for a high-end CPU? Now, I don't know if you really need a high-end CPU for a notebook, but, you know, if you don't put that in correctly and you don't put the heat spreader on and you don't make the contact right, you're going to have problems. Having taken apart many notebooks, it's not an easy thing. These things are really compact, you know, and the thermal properties of a heat sink on a CPU are very tight. So you don't want to mess it up. I'd be concerned about that kind of thing. But I do like the idea that you can put these parts in. I just don't know where you would buy them at. Where do you buy a mobile CPU? Where do you buy a mobile?
I guess that was kind of my idea. I mean, the memory definitely, because that's an upgradable thing. But most people don't buy mobile.
So I didn't follow the OCZ and what they're doing. Is maybe you're buying the base unit and then you just select upgrades?
I'm
curious. Can you actually just get the base unit without the CPU and the memory?
Yeah, that's how it sells. In fact, that's the way they do it. So you got to do it yourself. I mean,
we should look into that. You know, maybe we should have OCZ on.
I happen to
be very good friends with the VP of OCZ.
Oh,
so we could.
This is actually an open question to all the geeks here. What they think about this? Laptops,
notebooks.
Will end up at some point, like the miniaturization will end up with parts that are smaller than what will be handy to deal with. The screen and the keyboard are now the limiting factors. The keyboard, you don't want to get much smaller because you can't use it. The screens, you don't want to be smaller.
Yeah.
So do you think once you hit that point, or if we haven't already, that laptops will become more modular like the desktop systems are?
Yeah, I suppose it's possible.
That they will become more commodity items to swap out a CPU module, to swap out a memory module.
Isn't the biggest reason that they're not that the form factor is always specific, so that there's not like a standard like there are for cases for desktop machines. There's not that power supply standard and all those. They're all unique.
But that was a large part of – they were always trying to get smaller and smaller and smaller.
Right.
So once you hit that point where you're not worried about smaller size per se, because that's what happened with desktop PCs.
They're always going to be worried about size, because the smaller you get, then you can get it faster and faster if you keep getting it smaller. So you're going to be fighting that.
If you
want to
buy just a boxy notebook, you know,
like
that has no design like that OCZ there, then you can do this sort of thing. But, you know, companies like Sony and Apple, HP to some extent, they will design the case, give it to the engineer and say, put the hardware in here, and this is what we want you to – you've got to hit these these things, you know.
But and that's what makes it difficult. Isn't that what a desktop system is, though? That you have Intel, for example, saying, this is an ATX spec case.
Right.
Now make the parts for it.
Yeah, but it's not design-based like the laptops are.
You remember the new Apple that just came out that fits into the Air?
Mm-hmm.
So they came up with a case for that. Steve Jobs did and said, I want it to be this thin. You know, it's got to look like this. I guarantee they designed the case first, and then they put the electronics in it.
Yeah, and that's why they've got like a molded battery and a molded main card.
And people like that. They want to buy something that is, you know, it's got style, it's got design, that fits a form factor. But you're right. A lot of people don't. They don't care. All they want is the functionality,
Miles,
and there's no reason why you couldn't do what OCZ's doing.
Yeah, would you mind, like, you got a nice, pretty Apple laptop. Would you mind that being like an Eastern Bloc laptop, like all thick and bulky?
No, see, you're going back again to saying the things are going to get bigger. I'm saying things are constantly getting smaller to the point where
it won't matter.
It won't matter.
All right.
The keyboard needs to have a certain amount of travel.
The screen needs to be a certain size. I see that. GeekSpeak is supported by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Scotts Valley, offering computer rentals, printing, design, shipping, delivered office supplies, notary public, and more. Information is online at businesswithpleasure.com. Miles, how do you say notary public?
Notary public.
Notary public?
Yeah.
Is the public mean that they're a public notary? Why aren't they called public notary?
Because they hate you.
Okay,
no,
thank you.
It's notary republic.
It's not republic. Don't do that to me.
It's a republic of notaries.
You're listening to GeekSpeak.
They vote for the representatives.
Of notary, yes.
You're listening to GeekSpeak. My name's Lyle Troxel. The Geeks this morning, Sean Cleveland, Miles Elon, Ben Jaffe. We are taking your calls with questions and comments about technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. An extra special edition of GeekSpeak is happening this Tuesdays on Talk of the Bay. Rick Kleffel, Sean Cleveland, and I are speaking with author William Gibson. Sean, what are we talking with William Gibson about?
I think we're doing it virtually. We're going to connect our heads together with wires and just go into cyberspace and talk.
He's actually the founder of the term cyberspace.
So he is. He is the founder of the term cyberspace in his book Neuromancer. His latest book is called Spook Country, and it deals with,
art and virtual reality, but in this world.
They call it augmented reality, and it's really, really interesting concept of kind of taking history, things that happen in history, and tracking them today and making them important today.
Kind of think of like what you can do with Google Earth, where you start seeing different effects and photos and stuff, but instead of it being in a web screen, it's overlaid. It's, you know, VR goggle kind of stuff that are transparent. So you get to walk around in real world with added meta information about historic events, traffic information, things of that nature. So it's augmenting our reality. And I got to say that having an iPhone and traveling around San Jose, being able to, you know, do a search, look at my phone, look at traffic, know where I am by pushing a button. These things are augmenting my normal space.
It's like the Brookdale Lodge. I like the look of the old Brookdale Lodge.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's getting a facelift. And it's starting to look like a Motel 6, you know. It's looking very different. and someday I would just like to see augmented reality where I can actually put on, you know, a headset or something, standing in front of the Brookdale Lodge
and see what it
used to look like.
Oh, and then you might be able to get pictures from the 30s when it was like a speakeasy.
And I would see it three-dimensionally. Yeah. I would see exactly what it looked like.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the kind of stuff we're talking about.
So that's the kind of stuff we're talking about Tuesday at 10 on Talk of the Bay on KOSP. And I will add that to the podcast of GeekSpeak so that we have it all in one line. And then next week on GeekSpeak, it's still tentative, but it looks like we're probably going to have Adam Savage on from the Mythbuster. So that's GeekSpeak. This coming Tuesday at 10, and then next week, of course, every week at 10 to 11 on KOSP on Saturdays. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP. You're listening to GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxel, and Miles has something to say.
Yeah, Sean, if you wanted to see the Brookdale Lodge differently, that's what LSD is for. I'm just saying.
Please join our conversation right now. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877, or go use the internet. Thanks, all the people that helped make the internet. It's pretty cool. GeekSpeak.org. Click on Contact Us or participate in the forums. I feel like I've got more to do here, but let's go ahead and go on with the show. We did news stories. Does anyone else have one more news story? We've got some phones happening. Should we just go to phones, guys?
Up to you. I have a news story.
All right, go ahead, Miles.
Very quick. A 3D printer has been produced by some folks out there in, let me go back to the story again because I wasn't ready for it. some folks at the University of Bath in the UK have created a 3D printer that was able to print 3D objects, including copies of itself. So a 3D printer that can print itself.
This is an older story, Miles.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. We've covered it on GeekSpeak before, I believe.
We have.
In any case,
I've never
pretty
heard
cool.
A 3D printer that can print. I knew about a 3D printer that could print out.
You know
just
what?
Anything.
I'm just so on top of technology. Maybe I heard about it before it's happening. So the base.
Never mind then.
It can print components, and it can actually print all the components necessary to construct another one. It doesn't print a full copy of itself,
right?
But pretty much all the components.
It prints
you need.
Out the. Yeah. It's like the IKEA.
It won't print a motor. Or an ink cartridge.
But the general idea is most of the parts that it is. Are off the shelf.
They're like molded plastic
and then
that you
the
can't
that
just
you,
go buy.
The things you can't buy, it can print.
But if it could, do you think the company who built the printer would allow that to happen?
Well, the people that built the printer actually like scientists and geeks. They just made it. So it's not really like a corporation.
So there's no business model behind it?
Not really.
Yeah. That just fail.
It is an open source machine.
We made one.
Yeah, they did put the plans for the design it. So you can build your own.
It's actually open source hardware is the basic idea behind it. That's
really cool.
It's pretty cool. All right, let's go ahead and take a call. What the heck, right? From Pacific Grove, Gene, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello there.
Hi, welcome. What's your question today?
My question is sort of about Firefox. I ended up getting a Mac when I finally changed computers, and has Safari, I wanted to also go to CompuServe, which I had my old ISP.
Oh, I recall you calling about that.
Yeah. And you told me get Firefox because Safari couldn't get in. So I got Firefox, and sure enough, goes in.
Yay!
But I have Firefox off to the side, and I've been using Safari. It seems fine.
Mm-hmm.
And you're saying there's a new Firefox coming out. Now, if I want to have the latest edition of Firefox, the Mac just keeps updating all the time. How do I go get Firefox, the latest edition?
That's a darn good point. Because
I'll be putting the link up onto our website for also taking part in when the next version of Firefox comes out, which I highly recommend over the existing versions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So then you can put in your email address. You'll get a notification when that day is going to happen, and then you can be part of record breaking.
So in order to get on your forum, I got to go in and put in information about who I am, right?
Yeah, you do. And you don't have to participate in our forums to do this. Miles is going to have the link directly to the Firefox site for downloading the most recent version. And
I want to learn a lot of stuff, I should go put that information in so I can get into the forum. And
yeah, you can actually read our forums online without giving any information at all. It's completely all public. But when you want to participate, we have to get information from you so that we don't get spammed. It's really about spam control.
I got you. Is there a reason that that Safari couldn't go to CompuServe? I mean, are there places out there that just say we don't recognize Safari?
Yes. I mean, basically, CompuServe is doing something very bad there. But since CompuServe is kind of a defunct, dead space, it makes sense that people aren't working to fix the problems.
Oh, I got you.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's technically no reason.
Thanks a lot, guys.
You bet. Thanks for the call. Bye-bye.
And if you want to try out the Firefox 3 beta, or sorry, the release candidate, it's not actually officially out yet to the general public, and that's important to realize. So if you go to Firefox or Mozilla.com, it'll pop up with Firefox 2, and that's the current stable, definitely works version. And if you want to try Firefox 3, if you click around on the site, it's down in the lower right-hand corner, sneak peek.
And what Miles is saying is that they're going to try to break a Guinness World Record. So the idea is that you give them the email address. On the day they're going to release it, they send you an email, and that's the day you want to go ahead and download it.
Have to say the release candidates of Firefox 3, I prefer to Firefox 2.
Okay.
I don't think there's a good reason to get Firefox 2 at this point you don't already have it.
So if you need to get Firefox, just go to our link, which is going to go to Firefox 3's release candidate and soon full candidate. And we did get a call about Notary Public. Thank you very much, Mary Lee from Santa Cruz. The word comes from French, and therefore that's why the word order is the way that it is. Okay, well, thank you very much.
It almost sounds like Notary Public.
That's true. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe I should say it slower. Notary Public. Yeah, is that good? All right.
Or you can say it quickly. It still works.
All right. From Felton. That's where I live. Rick, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi.
What's your question today, Rick?
The scenario goes like this. I guess they have the Service Pack 3 out for updating XP.
Yes.
And I've got two laptops here that are Dell 6400 laptops, and of course it flew through that very nicely. on the HP Pavilion, it would not boot back up. On the when I installed the Service Pack 3, unfortunately for me, I did the stupid thing of doing an F10 recovery, which pulled the new XP off the D drive. What was it with HP that this? When I went online, I noticed that there was a bunch of stuff about HP Pavilions.
Well, in very commonly different types of OEMs will actually include different, slightly different versions of Windows. And the reason they do that is Windows, like when you buy it in the store and install it, has a whole bunch of extra drivers for everything under the sun. And an OEM actually wants to make the experience for the user easier and better. So what they do is they know what hardware and drivers they're going to be giving you with the system. So they give you an operating system that works well with that hardware. The problem with that is that when you go to do like a major update, like a patch, service pack release, Service Pack is looking for other things and is going to try to do a more extensive Service Pack upgrade. What I would do is go to HP and start with them and go, this is broken, we need to fix it, and see where they take you from there. I don't, and since you have another laptop, you're able to do some of the research, but I don't think it's going to be something we're going to be able to solve on air, except to say that prior to doing it, well, no. I mean, I always still would recommend Service Pack upgrades. I don't know. I think you're kind of stuck in this one. But definitely, is it still under warranty with HP?
No, not anymore.
Well, if other people are having problems, the error is going to emerge. The patch is going to emerge somewhere in the forums. Like, somebody smart's going to take a second and go, I figured it out, and then post it. And I would keep looking for that. Sorry about that.
Yeah, with the doing the F10 recovery, of course, it wanted to write over Windows XP over the thing, over the whole drive again.
Right.
Which meant that we lost a whole bunch of information
and
photos and things like that.
So you erased the system?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that stuff is, without expending a lot of money at a data recovery place, that stuff's not recoverable most likely.
Ah.
There are some recovery tools you could try running, like for photos, for example. The trick with them is that mostly they try to sell very hard. And so... I don't have a good one off the shelf that I recommend. I do my best now not to lose photos because it's so difficult when you have. So you've lost photos that you really want to get back?
Yeah.
Okay. There's a few applications that allow you to do a scan at a hardware level, like a very base scan to find JPEGs. Miles, got any solutions? Got any ideas on software to do that?
OnTrack data recovery.
OnTrack data recovery, Miles?
I'm not Miles, but... Yeah.
You tricked me. Try OnTrack. They probably have a demo version which will find the files and then say, pay us money, and then they'll recover them for you. And so the finding out if it will work will be free.
I see.
Okay. OnTrack.
Yeah, they're really good. Just go to OnTrackDataRecovery.com.
Okay.
All righty. Thank you for the call.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I've actually recovered data for using their software.
And it works?
Yeah.
All right. That's good.
It did for me. But if there are, if your hard drive is having electrical issues, then you're probably not going to be able to get to your data. The drive's got to be working.
Yeah, well, this is just an install of an operating system.
If you accidentally blew away your partition, you had data, you could use OnTrack to recover that. But if you're having like physical hard drive issues, probably not going to happen.
Have backups of your data instead. From Salinas, Warren, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Yes. I have a situation where the place I work basically is all Windows and IE6 mostly, and that's what I run at home. But I'm thinking of buying a MacBook toward the end of the year and running something like Boot Camp or whatever to be able to run Windows XP for the stuff I really need, which is mainly running Internet Explorer. And so I want to know, am I going to run into a lot of problems when I try to install Windows XP on this MacBook?
No.
With the hardware and so forth?
No, it's pretty easy. Apple actually has some good support for it. But actually, I would recommend a application called Parallels, which is a paid-for application. I believe it's under $100, which allows you to install Windows XP or some Linux versions or other versions of OS X even inside a virtual space. And the reason that's nice is that you won't have to reboot your computer to actually access Windows XP.
Okay, so it runs kind of like a virtual machine or something
yes,
like
that? Yes, it
does.
Yeah, it actually runs in a window, and you're running Windows XP inside the window. And it's pretty quick on the Intel
Well, it can be inside a window. It can also be completely integrated so that your Windows windows are right next to your OS X windows.
Yeah. I haven't run it like that. Does it work pretty well?
Yeah, it works fine. Mm-hmm.
So that's what I recommend. Go ahead and if you're going to buy a MacBook, go ahead and buy that. Then you have to buy a version of Windows XP. And then also the application parallels, and putting those all together is pretty easy to do.
Yeah, I have the Windows XP already. I just want to know about the hardware, and I just don't want to run Vista ever.
Right. Oh, you don't? Well, okay. Eventually, you probably will if the corporation you're using is using Windows Explorer for something important.
I think Vista's getting a bad rap.
Probably a year or more from now.
Oh, okay. You're getting well, Sean, we talked about Vista last week. I said that I'm using it and I really like it, but then I'm using a 64-bit version, so I can't speak about the 32-bit version. But Vista's getting better now. I think, what is it, Service Pack 1 that really made it better?
Well,
yeah, well I'm waiting for
not
the
really
Windows
better, but it helped.
7 or whatever they're going to end up calling it. I'm not going to do Vista.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Warren, for the call.
All right. Thank you.
Good luck. Bye-bye.
Yeah, it's a shame that Vista is just so heavy. I mean, it is. It is a big piece of software,
yeah.
You know, and you don't need to run most of it. So I really hope that the next version of Windows is more modular, lets you have more choice as to what you install. I would certainly like to see more speed out of an operating system. Didn't really see that with Vista.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I've been running multiple versions on different computers for a while. I haven't had any problems lately.
That's good.
And I'm running Service Pack 1.
You are running new hardware, though?
For the most part.
Yeah. Miles, you had some questions?
Yeah. I was thinking Parallels cost money. There's a cheaper option, although less convenient, which is Bootcamp, to be able to install Windows on a separate partition on your MacBook.
Right.
And then you just reboot whenever you're going to use Windows. It's less convenient than Parallels, but cheaper. So
yeah, that's actually what Warren. That's what Warren was starting with, and I get that it's cheaper, but you do burn up hard drive space because you can't really use the extra partition space inside Mac. And Ben, you had something?
Also, I was playing around with VMware Fusion, which is Parallels' competitor, and it's amazing. They're both very much neck and neck.
Uh-huh.
As far as I remember, Parallels started out way ahead, and then VMware Fusion, that's what it's called, right? Caught up, and now they're neck and neck as far as price and features and convenience and everything.
Can VMware Fusion use a Bootcamp partition?
He doesn't know. That was my first question, too.
Speak to that. I'll look it up.
If you are using Bootcamp on a Mac and then you want to open the applications in Windows inside of your Macintosh OS, you can actually run Parallels and point to your Bootcamp partition. And Miles, are you using that right now?
I was using it until Leopard came out, and then I lost control over my Bootcamp partition and updates.
Yeah. It ran away.
All right. Well
it turns out VMware actually can use a Bootcamp partition as well. So
you're listening to GeekSpeak. The Geeks This Morning are Ben Jaffe, Miles Elam, and Sean Cleveland. My name is Lyle Troxell. We are taking calls with questions and comments about technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. So Amazon went down 2 hours yesterday and lost $29,000 per minute. That's how much money Amazon makes per minute, which is kind of disgusting in some ways. I've noticed lately that Amazon's not as responsive to my service needs as it used to be. Anybody else have the experience with Amazon?
How do you mean? I bought stuff on Amazon. It was a fine experience for me.
Yeah, I bought some stuff on Amazon recently for the first time. Didn't get it when I expected to get it. Called them up. They had lost the tracking information. It was just a problem. Hmm. And that's a rarity for me. Anybody else buy a lot of stuff from Amazon?
I haven't bought from Amazon for a long time,
really?
Actually.
Okay.
I never think about it.
So the service went down yesterday. It was not an internet connection service problem. Their servers were responsive. It just said error. And it's a kind of a common web application error that happens sometimes. So the service is down. But the amazing thing is it took 2 hours to get back up. And I was wondering, Miles, have you read much more about this story?
Now, Alex is asking, is it Amazon or is it the affiliate stores? Because there are a lot of stores that are affiliates of Amazon that are not directly Amazon.
No, it was Amazon.com.
Well, no, the website was Amazon.com. My problems with shipping and stuff was an affiliate store. That's true. So
yeah, I saw the screenshots of it being down. By the time I saw the story, it was already back up again.
Yeah. Yeah.
Really? Okay.
And also the estimate of however many $1,000 of profit that they lost assumes that the people who tried didn't come back later.
Mm-hmm. Right, that's true. And it's really calculated out by, you know, they made $15 billion last year. And so if you calculate that per minute, that's $29,000 per minute that they're pulling in.
Yeah.
And so of course, yeah, that's all, you know, napkin scratch kind of math. We are waiting for calls and questions and comments. Technology, the phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. We're going to go ahead and go to Soquel. And Robin, welcome to GeekSpeak. Hello, Robin.
Oh, yes, hi.
Hi.
Question on backing up. I was hoping you would have some recommendations for hardware and or software that has an effective backup tool. They could say back up a whole hard drive.
Mm-hmm.
Not just data necessarily.
So you want to have a copy of your hard drive so that if your main hard drive fails, you can just swap it out and keep running.
Exactly.
How big's the hard drive in your computer?
Yep.
How big is the hard drive in your computer?
Oh, it's 160 gig, I think. Somewhere around in there. Maybe, yeah. 100.
Just about any backup solution out there nowadays is going to be able to handle that.
Yeah,
the problem is when you have a really large hard drive. Miles just ran into this.
If I have a RAID of drives, then I have to get a new hard drive.
You had about 750 gigs of data, and you needed to get a 750 gig drive to back it up so that you could...
Well, to get the data off of it,
to get the data off your RAID array so that you could upgrade your RAID array. So that's kind of a big issue.
So your hard drive's failing?
It looks like I have a heat issue with the NAS.
Have you taken the faceplate off?
Well, I don't think it's a actual heat issue. I think it's within the box that it has some defect that is causing.
I think we all use external RAID arrays.
Yeah.
To back up our data.
Okay, so for this mirroring of a hard drive, what's a good? Ben hasn't built his yet.
I keep getting stalled out.
for a good piece of software that will do a complete mirror of a hard drive, so that Robin could have a second hard drive on like a FireWire drive or USB drive, have a copy of his primary on there, and have it kept in sync. Do you guys know a good solution?
I would think the easiest thing would just be to go to a shop and buy any of the all-in-one backup solutions that are external hard drive. You press a button. After you install some software in your computer, you press a button, and it just does the backup.
Yeah.
In fact, if you go buy an external hard drive, like a Seagate, they've got drives with a button in front.
One button backup.
So exactly
one
button, does that. It
one
comes
touch.
Yep.
One
yeah, all of them. Like Western Digital has that. Maxter, although they're now Seagate.
So Robin, that's the way to do it. You just go to your local electronics store that sells hard drives and make sure that has one that has the one button backup.
Great, thank you.
And it'll have the software with it.
It really, it's just so easy. They make it really easy.
Thanks, Robin, for the call.
Thank you.
I can't believe the prices of external hard drives now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you could buy a 250-gig drive for like $40-$50 in an enclosure, add another $20. I mean, it's just really...
Yeah, but a 750 is 110.
Yeah. Is that what it is?
It's
in an enclosure?
It's down to like 18 cents.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, the bare drive.
Yeah.
It's down to like 18 cents a gig.
So there is no... So for about $50 right now, pretty much anyone can get a backup solution that will work for their computer.
I would say more like 75.
Okay.
Just because, you know, smaller hard drives, you still have to have the same... electronics aside from the platter.
Right.
So,
see, that's what I was saying, it makes more sense to go the larger. Like 750 gigabytes is really the best price point at this.
I would say biggest bang
for the buck.
Or I would say 500 right now. But it's. I think we're in transition between 500 and 750.
I was thinking like bare drive 500 is going to cost you something on the order. I don't know what particular.
The reason I'm bringing up is that pretty much 80% of the population does not have their backup solution handled, and they have photographs of their family and friends that are on their one hard drive, and it's just a matter of time before it crashes. And when it does crash, you're talking $2,000 to $3,000 to recover that data. So right now, you go out and spend $110 like that to make sure you've got a backup solution with a one button push, and now you can sleep at night. And that's why I'm pushing the idea.
Basically.
There are a lot of restless people out there who aren't getting any sleep, apparently.
You know, look for the word synchronize. You want a solution that synchronizes your data, because if you just do a dumb backup, you're going to have to copy all your data, and this is going to take forever. Synchronize will actually just back up the changes that are made, and it's much quicker, and you'll do it more often.
Don't most of them do that? Like set up
I'm just saying. I don't know.
Just in case.
But yeah. Synchronizing your data is kind of a smarter approach to backing up your data.
It means that
kind of vocabulary.
Yeah, I agree. It
means you do like a full backup once a month or something like that, but then on a daily basis, you just back up the changes you made that one day and not have to do
it. You should only have to do the one backup once.
So
all the data.
So earlier this morning when I was waiting for Sean to pick me up, I was watching a video about net neutrality. And I think it's one of the things we don't cover very much on GeekSpeak. We kind of talk about, but I want to make a really clear stance that and description of net neutrality. And that is that the internet's made up of a whole bunch of computers interconnected, and the computers themselves are owned by anybody. Corporations own them. I own one personally, or GeekSpeak, I should say, owns one and is in a hosting facility. And it's a very free speech kind of environment. And the one thing that ties all those things together is the interconnections, the network itself, and the getting access to the network. So when you go, you know, buy DSL service or cable internet service or go to a coffee shop and use Wi-Fi, all those points are controlled by basically phone and cable companies. And they want to start restricting the traffic flow and charging different amounts based on what kind of things you're doing and what targets you are. They basically want to make toll fees that are different based off of content. It's okay for them to charge us to connect to the network. I'm fine with that. But once you connect and have a certain bandwidth, there should be no controls of what you can do with that bandwidth.
Right. What sites you can visit.
Right. It's like double billing.
Yeah.
That by putting the server, if you put a server up for people to access, the idea is that you're paying for how many people want to access your service. If you want 1 million people to access your service, you're going to pay more than you would if you wanted 100 people to access your service. And if you're at home, you're paying for a a cable or DSL connection, something like that. And if you want to download things faster, you pay more than if you want to download things slower. With net neutrality, or the lack of net neutrality, you should say, is that after everyone has paid that amount, then you're going to pay extra to say, well, we want the content from AT&T or from Comcast to come faster than the content from Google.
Right.
So... But if you don't want that to happen, yes.
Net neutrality is basically saying you can't modify, the ISPs cannot control that. And I highly support it. I just want people to be aware of that. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of online tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. GeekSpeak is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. The Geeks this morning were Miles Elam and Ben Jaffe and Sean Cleveland. Tuesday morning at 10 a.m. on Talk of the Bay, it's a special edition of GeekSpeak and your chance to talk with the in-studio guest, William Gibson. In 1982, his novel Neuromancer invented cyberspace as we know it today. His new novel, Spook Country, offers a look at a present most of us cannot quite comprehend. Call in to talk about the future with William Gibson, Sean Cleveland, Lyle Troxell on GeekSpeak, hosted by Rick Kleffel on Tuesday at 10 a.m. at Central Coast Public Radio. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio. KUSP Santa Cruz, KBDH Santa Cruz on the web at KUSP.org. My name is Lyle Troxell. You've been listening to GeekSpeak. You just listened to another episode of GeekSpeak via our podcast. Would you do us a favor? Please go to your favorite podcasting index site, whether it be iTunes, Dig.com, Odeo, or another site, and write a review or give us a vote to let others know what you think about GeekSpeak. Thanks, that'd really help us out. GeekSpeak is supported by PreownedCar.com, PreownedCar.com, where anyone can post their vehicle for sale or browse to purchase a pre-owned car from other car owners. More information available at PreownedCar.com. This is Lyle Troxell for KUSP. Thanks for listening.